listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Manu Chao with Despedida. And, you know, we were talking, of course, about the issue of migrant workers coming to North America. And indeed, there is so much propaganda surrounding that, you know, very racist propaganda that comes from reactionary forces, both in Canada and the United States, you know, saying, of course, that these migrants are here to take our jobs. They're, you know, like they're to undermine the wage base of Canadian workers and all this sort of stuff. Like, you know, they give you all this kind of propaganda, like trying to divide working people against each other. They do that, of course, everywhere, every chance that they get, because, of course, it empowers them and diminishes the power of the working class if they manage to get away with that. If they manage to, like, get workers to turn on each other. And, you know, that really is the function of racism when it comes to perpetuating capitalism. It's the reason why they find racism useful. But, indeed, there also is other propaganda the capitalist class uses, of course. Like, there's been many, many studies that have come out, you know, in recent years. Like, you know, the IMF and World Bank are champions of doing this. And, of course, it gets published in The Economist and various, like, mainstream kind of news sources that, you know, supposedly educated people read, quote-unquote. And, you know, they talk about how things are getting better. You know, like, places like India, capitalist countries in the third world and stuff, things are getting better. Incomes are rising. People are rising out of poverty. You know, things are getting better. Things are improving. And capitalism is, you know, is responsible for that. You know, they really try to make you believe that capitalism is working for ordinary people around the world. You know, they really, really try to drive that message home. And that, you know, this is the natural outcome of the capitalist system. This is what capitalism does. It lifts people out of poverty. You know, total nonsense. Whenever, of course, like, people have actually lifted themselves out of poverty, it's usually been in defiance of the capitalist system, you know, fighting back against exploitation, you know, fighting back against oppression, fighting back and trying to take at least some control over their own lives, you know, at the expense of those people, of course, you know, of at the expense of the capitalist class. You know, of course, the capitalist class just wants to use people as tools for creating profit. That's what the capitalist class wants. So if people want to assert any sort of self-determination, any sort of control over their own lives, you know, they have to rise up against that. Whether that's workers going on strike or, you know, wholesale revolutions, that's what ultimately people have to do. And that's always what has made things better in this world. It's not the capitalist system itself. You know, we get a lot, but still, we get a lot of propaganda from the capitalist system trying to justify itself, trying to say, oh yeah, we're responsible for, like, bettering conditions around the world, you know. And needless to say, like I said with Greece, there's more to it than that. Because just the fact that incomes are rising, even if that's true, often that's not the complete picture, as this next story concerning India really shows. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Welcome to The Real News Network. I'm Jessica Devereaux in Baltimore. As part of our economic coverage here at The Real News, we want to introduce you to the latest research from the Political Economic Research Institute at UMass Amherst. Our guest today is Deepankar Basu. He's an assistant professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and he recently completed research related to the growth of the service sector in India. He joins us today to discuss his working paper titled, Why is Calorie Intake Falling, if Income is Rising in India? Thank you for joining us, Deepankar.
Thank you for having me.
So I find this to be very interesting as a way to talk about economics through how much food people consume. But essentially, from my understanding, calorie intake tends to increase with income, right, Deepankar? But we're seeing the opposite trend happening in India. So can you explain and answer that question in your paper? Why is calorie intake falling if income is rising in India?
Yes, that's correct. If we look at countries across, at a point in time, across countries, or if we look at different states in India at a point in time, calorie intake increases with income. So those who are rich generally consume higher amount of calories. In India, on the other hand, from the last 20 years, income has been growing at a fast pace, but we have seen average calorie income intake decline. So that is really a puzzle, and economists and policymakers have started studying that this, and now people call it the calorie consumption puzzle. Now, there are various explanations that have been offered in the literature as to why this is happening. One prominent explanation is what is known as the declining calorie need. And there are two essential elements of this explanation. One, that the structure of the economy is changing. People are moving out of agriculture. Agriculture is very physically demanding. And so as they move from agriculture to less physically demanding work, they require less calories. The second element is that the epidemiological environment in the country is improving. So as the epidemiological environment improves, diseases like diarrhea, the incidence of those diseases go down, and therefore people are able to retain higher amounts of calories that they consume. So people have put these two elements together to argue that the calorie needs have gone down, and that's why we observe people consuming lower calories.
But you don't agree with that. What are you guys theorizing?
We don't agree with this explanation for many reasons. First, the Indian Council of Medical Research comes up with calorie norms, what they think to be the minimum amount of calorie that is required for a healthy living. And when we look at the calorie intake across the country, we see a vast majority of the population falling below that calorie norm. Not only that, over time, more and more people have fallen below this calorie norm. Second, if we look across the world, the amount of malnutrition and other kinds of problems in India are comparable or even worse than many sub-Saharan African countries who are much poorer than India. So because of this, we believe that calorie needs cannot be a full explanation. There must be some kind of constraints operating on households, which is forcing them to consume lower calories. And we offer one explanation or one mechanism of how such a constraint might operate.
Okay, let's talk about these household constraints. What in particular?
So what we suggest is that we can divide up the expenditures of households into two types of essential elements. One we can call food, and another we can call non-food essentials. What would go into this non-food essentials would be expenditures on essential services like healthcare, education, transportation, and other important services which are required for daily life. Now, our explanation of the calorie decline is that over the last 20 years, because of various structural factors in the economy, the households have been forced to spend more and more on these essential services, and therefore the income growth that we see has been completely taken up by these non-food essentials, and therefore the amount that is left to be spent on food has not increased.
Let's talk specifics here. What specific policies, like you mentioned, healthcare, transportation, what has changed over time? Why are people paying more out of pocket?
So one big change that has happened is from the early to the mid-80s onwards, there has been a gradual shift in the policy in India in the central level and also at the state level. More and more neoliberal policies have been adopted. One important element of the neoliberal set of policies is that the public provisioning of essential services like education, healthcare, public housing, transportation has been reduced. So therefore, households have been forced to replace this expenditure that earlier the state used to provide by private expenditure. And that, we are suggesting, has taken up all the income growth.
All right. Deepankar Basu, thank you so much for joining us from Amherst, Massachusetts. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on the Real News Network.
Say yes to our hopes and our plans. Forget about your indecision. Let's get the beast off our land. A tree that can grow no longer. a beach that has got no sand. I would pay out a king's ransom if we could just understand. Hey! Chain, the world infanticide, that robot car, your jobs will disappear, it's called the politics of a brand new year. Manhattanization is coming, oh yeah, and open your eyes if you dare, and carry your son to the crossroads, come to your senses and care.
3.3 here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That, of course, was Midnight Oil with Progress. And needless to say, this is not the kind of progress we should be fighting for. You know what we're seeing like in India right there, where, of course, the even though people are making higher incomes, what capitalism is also doing is it is destroying any sort of security that people have. So, of course, people are actually eating less and less, even as the economy is growing. And, of course, India has higher rates of malnutrition and starvation than sub-Saharan Africa does. This is like India's dirty secret. This is what the government of India, the capitalist state in India, definitely doesn't want to be talked about, let's just say. And of course, like, there's no capitalist state that actually wants, you know, their dirty secrets out for everyone to see. Certainly the United States doesn't want to. No country in the world wants that. But this is what capitalism is doing to India. It's killing people. It's killing thousands and thousands and thousands of people every year, you know, and that's just from hunger. That's not from even counting the deaths from repression, which are massive. You know, like the Indian state is basically making war on its own people. You know, any indigenous groups within India that rise up and try to protest, you know, they get violently suppressed. You know, even massacred by the forces of the state in India, you know, and this is not something the international media virtually like ever pays attention to. You know, so once again, this is what capitalism does to people. It destroys any security that they have. You know, and where they basically just, you know, and forces them to sell their labor. You know, at the lowest possible, for the lowest, you know, for low wages, you know, virtually nothing, just starvation wages. And, you know, there is, and that's what it reduces people to. You know, this is what capitalists want, right? They want the, they want to pay workers the bare minimum, right? Always. Because that means more profits for them. Now, I want to take this opportunity, of course, like give a little, you know, shout out to an event which is actually happening in Guelph this this coming Wednesday, July 15th at 5 p.m. at Sheldale Community Center, which is 20 Sheldale Crescent here in Guelph. So this is in the Willow Road area. This is 15 in Fairness Community Meeting and Dinner. Now, this this is an event which is put on by 15 in Fairness Guelph, a group which I am part of, which is fighting for a $15 minimum wage here in this country, you know, and of course, it's up against some serious opposition as it's lobbying the Ontario government, trying to pressure the government into actually making this kind of concession that would, of course, improve the lot of working people who, of course, are dealing very much with high rents, high costs, you know, of fuel and energy and, you know, what have you. And, of course, the minimum wage is nowhere near high enough to cover their expenses. So many people are going into debt. You know, and, of course, the number of low-paying jobs. I mean, that's really where the jobs are at in this economy right now. The low-paying, temporary jobs, they offer no security, very, very few benefits. And people are living with this. So something like a $15 minimum wage would certainly ease the burden on many, many people. And this is why we're fighting for it. You know, this is why people all over this country are fighting for this. And if you want to become a part of that struggle, if you want to take part in a discussion about how to build that struggle here in Guelph, fighting for a $15 minimum wage, please come out. Once again, that's Wednesday, July 15th, 5 p.m., Sheldale Community Center here in Guelph, 20 Sheldale Crescent, 20 Sheldale Crescent. And, you know, please come out. I mean, that's, you know, there's a free dinner and you can become a part of this movement, which is, you know, I'm happy to say is growing all over the country. You know, people fighting for this really, you know, something which really is in the interest of working people in this country. Something which working people really need, but it would ease their burden, you know, most definitely. And this is something, you know, we need people to be in on. So please, if you can, please come out. So, just to kind of like encapsulate a lot of the things which I've said in this show, I'm going to play a speech that Michael Parenti gave in Vancouver several years ago, where he talks about really the capitalist system, resistance against the capitalist system, and just, you know, just really what the entire thing's all about. And he really lays it clearer than I ever could. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. I'm going to end the show on this note. So solidarity, brothers and sisters. I hope to see you out next Wednesday at the 15 in Fairness meeting at, once again, that's 20 Sheldale Crescent here in Guelph at 5 p.m. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. Actually, I have to excuse me. Actually, I don't actually have the Michael Parenti talk, which I told you about that I was going to play. So actually what I'm going to play is Michael Parenti's recent interview on austerity and the politics of austerity, which he did right here on Back in the USSR a few months ago. So please stay tuned for that. Okay, hello everyone. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. We are speaking to Dr. Michael Parenti, progressive author and scholar based in Berkeley, California. And we're going to talk to him about his recent book, which I believe just came out in April of this year. It's called Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies. And you can read more of Michael's stuff at michaelparenti.org. And I'll mention that again later on. So hello, Michael. How's it going?
Hello. How are you, Siegfried?
Pretty good. It's been a while since we last talked, so I'm glad we got this opportunity to do so, especially in light of, well, I mean, just everything that's been going on in the world now and, like, the appropriate timing, I think, of this this book you've just put out. So,
thank you.
Yeah, if we maybe could just kind of launch right into things. My first question is basically if you could just outline what is austerity.
Well, austerity is the imposition, the imposing upon the working people scarcity and hardship. And that's done by those at the top who work us,
mm-hmm.
and who have all sorts of political rallies where they talk about the loafers and the lazy people and who don't want to work and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they blame, and the poor are always blamed for their own poverty. They are seen as the authors of their own poverty, when in fact that's not true. And the truth is that wealth creates poverty. In many instances, poverty is the creation by wealth. I mean, slaves wasn't their laziness. They put in 18-hour days of toil of all kinds, and the plantation owners' wealth and luxury and accumulation was from the exploitation of the poor. So that's how you get wealth. A few people will expropriate the land and labor and resources of everybody else. That's one of the points one has to make. Well, mm-hmm. what was it you were asking again?
Well, this is what is austerity, basically, right? Like, of course, we're hearing this term, like, all the time these days, like, about austerity, the need for austerity. It's like the language, the chosen language, you could say, of the elite, which is kind of imposing this. And you see in Europe, we see in North America, we see, like, really all over the world now since the recession.
They don't want to say homelessness and hunger and no access to medical care.
Right.
You know, they call it austerity. You know, like learn to curb and don't be a freeloader and all that. When in fact, it's the rich. It's that 1% or one fraction of 1% at the top that is really the freeloader. Nobody goes to the government for more handouts than the very very super rich. They they have enormous amounts of policies and programs for their own benefit. If I don't lose my voice here, I think you got my point.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's it almost seems like austerity is almost like a feature of the capitalist system in general. It's just the word maybe has kind of come into vogue, but I mean, they've been doing this for a long time, right?
Yeah, they most certainly have been doing it for a long time. Yes, that's correct. Yes. And whenever there was a set of circumstances at World War II that changed things around a bit. We came out of a deep depression
mm-hmm.
that had lasted about 15 years. I mean, the New Deal did a lot of good things, but, you know, it never really got the U.S. out of its depression. And then came the war.
Mm-hmm.
The war was actually a lot of good-paying jobs for people. The ruling class spent amounts of money to kill people and destroy towns and cities, an amount that it would not spend in peacetime to get people out of the Depression. But that war got people out of the Depression. 9 million American men, mostly men, almost all men, came back from the war, and there was a GI Bill that was passed for them. And that was a remarkable thing, because unlike the GI Bill today, where where veterans have to also get a job on the side
mm-hmm.
or take out student loans or whatever else, the GI Bill does not help them the way it promised to really do. But in those days, it did, and it also gave money for small businesses to start and all that. So there was a tremendous burst of prosperity, of spending. there was a pileup of money that people had from 4 years of working in the defense plants where they couldn't spend that money because all those factories were not making refrigerators and stoves and cars. They were making bombs and planes and tanks and things of that sort. So this combination of things, plus there was not a stripping down. There was a big stripping down of the military, of course, but a substantial military was kept going 1946-47 because of the Cold War was starting. The Red Army was on the Elbe. The big communist parties in France and Italy. The workers in Western Europe were developing social democracies. They were getting free medical care. They were getting job programs, free education. These things that they were doing that because people in Eastern Europe were getting the same kinds of things, and it was a sort of a historic compromise. Which we had to, you know, keep up with the Reds. And here, here in the communist countries, people spent only one tenth of their salary for rent. They had free medical care. They had free education up to the highest level of their abilities. They had very subsidized and improved transportation, and all these kind of things were happening. So the West had to do some of the same things, and it was what were being built then in those days was you had a well-being that had never existed quite like that before in the West, and that's when the mythology also emerged that America is the land of prosperity, and for whatever prosperity, they really advertised it and ideologized it, if I can create a word. It was part of the ideology that only in America everybody's got a car now, and the whole transportation infrastructure was built with government money, people's public money, to subsidize the automotive industry, and these superhighways were built and all of that at public expense for the trucking industry and the automotive industry's benefit. And this went on and on, and then when you got to the late 70s, early 80s, they started turning it all around. Reagan came in, and there was the feeling was enough is enough. We've got to roll this back, and they've done a terrific job of doing just that thing. And so you now have that great prosperous middle class that we always heard about and all that, now much pitied and much. Rolled back and going broke in many instances.
Yeah. So of course we see this kind of momentary historical compromise that now is being clawed back, and I guess austerity is the latest incarnation, at least of the language of that rollback.
Right. Austerity and impoverishment and oppression, those were the normal conditions of capitalism in the United States all through the 1800s and the early 1900s and right up until the late part of the 20th century, the 80s or so is the turnaround, and you get more and more of it today. Today, mm-hmm. have students graduating college with $75,000 debts. You know, you have the same rollback going on, of course, now in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
They don't owe the working class anything anymore. They just started rolling them back. And Richard Pipes, of all people, I mean, a conservative like him, I'll give him credit. He didn't suppress the study, but he did the study of all the former communist countries. You know how things are, and it came out overwhelmingly. People saying it was better under communism.
Mm-hmm.
Better under communism, you know. The farmers would say it was better. We got subsidies. We could sell our stuff and this and that and students. It was better for them. It was better for public transportation. Was better. The healthcare system was more equitable, and more accessible. And you can go on. So that's what they're really. The whole game is really a class. Class struggle game. That's what it is.
Yeah. If I could go back to something you mentioned very briefly before, was just how war is now being like tied in with austerity. You see, like, you know, with austerity now, you see increased rise of interventions of like basically the American military and Western military forces abroad, and increased violence around the world, and increased interventions and these kind of things. So how does that really imperialism tie in with austerity?
Well, imperialism, the empire feeds off the republic. I mean, where does an empire get its operational wealth from? From the republic, from the people. You got to tax the American public. How do you get to tax them, and so that you have a federal budget every year in which 52% is for military purposes, right there? That's just 52% off the top. And not to mention a lot of other things, military pensions, all sorts of other stuff. But so the way you do that is you convince your public that this is for their safety. We have to control the world, or the world will devour us. And so we've been seeing it again and again and again. Imperialism is an extension, an outgrow of capitalism, but it's also a way of making the world safe for the plutocracy. That's really its great goal, and to provide places for investment and further profit at greater margins than before.
Yeah, and I guess this kind of goes into the whole profit pathology, right? Because, I mean, I think you even said in one of your talks, you know, the whole idea that capitalism can never stay home. Like, it has to keep expanding. And if it doesn't expand, I mean, basically it collapses, right? So, I mean, like, imperialism and capitalism, I guess, go hand in hand with regard to that.
It's a mad system. That's why I said pathology. I mean, yeah, it is a mad system. It's designed to pay workers as little as possible and yet hope that there'll be many workers with lots of spending power to pick up all these commodities and services that I'm creating with these underpaid workers, you know. And my hope is that some other owner will give their workers enough money so they'll have the money to buy up the goods and services that my underpaid workers are creating. But the other owners have the same idea, and they, too, underpay their workers. And so there's a chronic overproduction. There's a chronic underconsumption. Even though we have a big consumer society, there's all sorts of crap that you got more things, you know, consumer items and gizmos, and even in the area of food, where the food is, some of the fast food stuff is uneatable, but there it is, and expensive and cheap in some cases, but. So imperialism is the outgrowth of capitalism. War brings a false prosperity, you know. And socialism, what imperialism is socialism coming to the rescue again. Capitalism is always rescued by the government. I mean, the number of programs of research and development in all sorts of areas, the railroad industry, the mining industry, the steel industry, the airline industry, the internet industry, all these things are publicly owned. That plutocratic class that constantly denounces the government, constantly scolds the American people, as you're saying, austerity, stop looking for a handout from the government, stop running off to the government with silly, wasteful things like Social Security and Medicare. And all. If I didn't have those, I'd be out on the street right now myself. I'm telling. No, it's not funny.
So, well, I mean, there's a lot of people, right? Like, who face that.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said before, the irony is, of course, that same plutocracy goes to the government, I mean, owns the government, I mean, gets more subsidies, agribusiness, trillions of dollars in subsidies, pharmaceuticals, trillions, the medicine industry, and now with Obamacare, you've got the health insurance industry piping up their racket. It's gotten more. It's given people more services, but it has been a. But these guys get their shakedown before we ever see any services.
Yeah, and I guess this is the real face of the capitalist state, right? The state serving the capitalist class, like these, the Fortune 500. I guess you could say serving their interests and not the interests of the people.
That's correct. It ends up serving their interests. They'll take any good program or need that's needed. They'll argue against it. They'll denounce it. But then they'll put through a version of it where they end up walking away with enormous profits.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you have to engage in a big ideological struggle against the capitalists or imperialists, at least with people when trying to convince them. What I did in this book, Profit Pathology, is I suggested a very simple empirical approach to, rather than an ideological struggle of grand isms, my superism against your superism or whatever, and just do empirical choices. Just look at things. I say, let's have socialism wherever socialism works better than capitalism. Well, we've been taught that socialism's a flop and it doesn't work, and that's that. But, public utilities work much better than private utilities. The rates are cheaper, the service is better. You don't have CEOs who are making $2-4 million a year as CEO of the utility. You don't have all the kickbacks and whatever else. Mm-hmm. We have a private utility here in California, PG&E, which brought death to users in San Bruno, where people in San Bruno were smelling gas and complaining and saying there's a gas leak somewhere here, and the company is too busy scooping up profits for itself. And it blew up, and 8 people were killed, and another 35 were seriously hurt, and about 40 or 50 houses. If you had seen the photos, I don't know if you ever got them there. They were staggering. These houses were just blown right off their foundations. Just nothing there, torn apart like a tornado or something. So public utilities are better. The rates are lower. Your surplus doesn't go to stockholders to enrich them. Your surplus goes into the public budget, and that helps the taxpayers a little, Let's look at schools. Public schools, public universities are better than private ones. The idea that we now have more and more private for-profit universities, for-profit. The school admits that it creates this university to make profits for its shareholders, not for education. Well, again, it would be a lot cheaper if you just have a public university, that you don't have to be producing large amounts of wealth for the shareholders. All the money goes back into the school. How about public medicine, public health care, public hospitals? Mm-hmm. They're better. And the things that public transportation is so much more efficient, so much better for the environment and the like. Our public transportation here carts more people than that congestion and slaughter of cars does. So what do we do for capitalism? Maybe restaurants restaurants. We can say it's better that the restaurant is owned by mom and pop and they really have the little touch to it than having the state. Judging from my experience with restaurants in socialist countries, I might lean in that direction. So what I'm saying is, instead of getting into an isms fight, let's just go social function by social function and say, well, what's been better? What's been better? Tell us, really.
Yeah, like just kind of bring it down to like that empirical level, right? I mean, I have a similar story, actually. I mean, you were telling me the story about what happened in California where, like, those houses were blown away.
Yeah.
Once again, there's a result of that private company, and the cutbacks and all this kind of stuff. A similar thing happened in Ontario in the 1990s. In this case, it had to do with the privatization of water systems. And,
yeah.
This is something that definitely should be in the public domain, needless to say.
Now, if there's an accident with a public system,
Yeah, this was
never an end to it. And you say, you see, these systems don't. It's not good. It doesn't work. And you should give it to a private company.
Yeah.
That's more. And they immediately elevate it into an ism thing, you know, and so
yeah.
forth. But it's not true when it happens to them, when you got the BP blowing up oil floats and destroying half of New Orleans and all that, they just say, oh, that was an accident.
Yeah,
they don't raise the question of is this the way capitalism operates? Well, this
right.
is terrible. This is life threatening. This is destroying our environment and our city and our people. They don't say that. They just say, "Oh well, there's been an accident. We got to clean it up." Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then the cleanup goes to social.
Oh, right, yeah.
Also, and they have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Like the public has to pay the cost every time, right? I mean, in the Ontario case, it was a town called Walkerton.
Yes.
And basically, this place, you know, they had privatized the water system, and because
it was
of the
a private one, you said, did yeah, you say Siegfried? I didn't hear you.
Yeah, they privatized the water system there.
Oh.
And basically what ended up happening is it got contaminated by E. coli due to, lack of oversight and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
About, like, 8 people ended up dead. Like, hundreds more got sick, and then most of the people who died were kids, right?
Oh, my God.
So, like, this kind of thing, like, happened. It was a big scandal back in, like, 1995. Like,
did
this happened, right?
Did they put it under public ownership again, or it's still privately owned?
Well, I mean, these days it's, like, kind of more of, like, a public-private kind of... partnership or whatever it is they call it. I mean, basically, it's like maybe some increased oversight, but it's mostly like in the private domain still.
Yeah.
And there's like a lot of privatization going on now. I know the hydro system's about to get privatized and sold off right up here. It's a big, big thing. I mean, some people are being mobilized around it right now. Because that was the next thing I was actually going to ask you about. Like, how are people fighting back against these kind of policies, which are very, very anti-worker, anti-public in general?
Well, they get angry about certain things. You know, PG&E, the company I was telling you about, they were given $42 million. Again, socialism supporting capitalism. Gave them money to rebuild all various pipelines that had problems, were brittle, leaking, or chipping, or showing signs of being ready to blow up or something.
Mm-hmm.
They did all that, but... But it didn't really, you know, it wasn't used. It wasn't used for those purposes. PG&E took that money and waged a campaign, a statewide referendum, to prohibit any kind of public utilities in the state of California. They spent millions. They spent millions of dollars on this campaign, and miracle of miracles, they lost anyway. The people.
Yeah.
Did not want to hand over all the utilities to the private profiteers, and I deal with these things in my book. Some of those things, and I also talk about in my book Private Pathology and Other Indecencies. I also talk about how small little things, or you talk about austerity. How about Holocaust? How about extermination? 12 to 18 million native.
Mm-hmm.
Indigenous peoples in North America, who and 500 language groups were all destroyed from what 1600 to 1890, almost 3 centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Just destruction to take an immense fortune from them, an immense fortune of mineral deposits, of water, of forests, lands, topsoil. I mean, a huge enriched continent taken over, stolen, and killing the people, exterminating the people who are on the land, you know. And that's another thing. And then the immense capital accumulation from slavery, which people don't usually talk about, but you know, cotton was probably the greatest value production of any. I mean, more than coal, more than iron, more than just about anything else for quite a while. It was, and again, that was on the labor of African slaves, people who were brought in here and enslaved in terrible ways. This is the so-called primitive accumulation, indeed primitive, I would say, murderously primitive. And so I guess the story I'm saying is the system is an amazing system of horrors and abuses and murder and destruction and holocausts. And it's all sort of normal. The crises of capitalism, just about every few years, there's a crisis, there's a panic, there's a drop, there's a recession, and it's still going on to this very day. There's still a recession going on right now.
Mm-hmm. And so would you say, like, people are increasingly waking up to the reality of the system here?
I don't know. There certainly are many who are just as stupid and blind to it and bought into it as ever. They watch Fox News and they get roped in. But there are people who are seeing. Look at the protests of the Occupy movement. That was very unusual for the U.S. anyway. Probably better in Canada. I think ideologically somewhat more developed in Canada than they are in the United States. Although there could be plenty of work done there, too. And even in Europe, I think the Europeans were so far ahead and sophisticated. The more I spoke in Europe and went, I realized, my gosh, they got some of the wool has been pulled over their eyes, too, in some instances, you know. Yeah, it's just got a lot. There's just an awful. What the wake up was with the Occupy movement. It was just that one little phrase: 1% versus 99%.
Right.
So suddenly, the great divide that you and I and others have been trying to get across and say, look, there's a great divide here, financially, ideologically, anyway. And then developing it a little more, and you say, wait, it's not 1%. 1% of the American population is 3 million people. No, they're not super rich. You can be up there in the top 3 million with $200,000 a year, and you're up in that bracket almost. This is like a fraction of 1%. You know, it's a hundredth of 1%. That the super rich have never been more unequal among themselves than they are today. And in other words, in America, in any case, we still don't even realize, we don't know how rich the super rich really are. We look at these homes up on the hill here in Berkeley, and then they go for $2 million, and they're very nice homes indeed. I would never be able to afford such a place. But that's not rich, you know. That could be a professor with tenure and some smart investments could probably float a house like that or something. The very rich are people who live in places where you don't see their front yards that easily, you know, because there's a gate and there's a great estate and there's a special pad for a helicopter or a private plane, and they live really very different.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, there certainly has been people waking up, though. I mean, like, I've been quite impressed by the campaigns for raising the minimum wage, which are, like, in a lot of U.S. cities now, and a lot of, like, low-wage workers, like, from McDonald's even, like, who, you know, most people wouldn't even see them going out on strike, but they're going out on strike. And there's, like, quite a few actions. Like, it seems like a lot of places. And even in Ontario now, like, we're starting to see, you know, raise the minimum wage to $15. Like, that's becoming a pretty big thing now.
Yes, and as I say, it gets back to that madness and that contradiction of not paying the people who you need as customers. You know?
It's true, you know. And well, I mean, another thing, of course, like Indigenous peoples. I mean, we talked about that before, all the things that they've suffered at the hands of, like, you know, they say primitive accumulation, and they're increasingly politically active. You know, like they, you might have even seen the picture from this when I was in Washington D.C. A few months ago, right? And, like, you know, they raised the Mohawk flag outside the White House, and these were people who were coming down in support of Ecuadorian activists who were campaigning against Chevron, you know, what it's done to the Ecuadorian rainforest.
Yeah.
You know, and the devastation that it's caused down there, right? So, I mean, you see these, I mean, that was some very real international solidarity there. And you also had, like, the indigenous dynamic in there as well. And it was very amazing to be a part of that.
And sometimes it does reach a point where the oppression can be so extreme that the people who are oppressed have no choice but to fight back. And, I mean, when you think of it, who the hell can live on $7 an hour? I mean,
it's true.
At least in this country, the way prices are, the prices are still going up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Gas went down, big deal. Well, that's something, but it's really a shame. It's a shame. It's an insult. It's an offense to people's humanity. It is. So that's what the book is about. I wrote a lot of stuff in there, and it's only 150 pages, but I sort of had fun packing it in. I shouldn't say have fun. Sometimes it was with a painful grimace, but that's the way it goes.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, this is some pretty serious stuff we're talking about here, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. Indeed.
This book, once again, like, sounds very interesting. I know I'm going to try to read it as soon as I can. And this is Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies,
mm-hmm.
which I think you – who publishes that?
It was it's Rutledge and Paradigm Publishers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. And so once again, like, your website is michaelparenti.org.
That's correct.
And so if people want to, like, read more of your articles or find out about more of your your books,
mm-hmm.
you know, just they can go and check that out. Well,
yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I guess probably what we should end on is Antonio Gramsci's quote. You know, just all we've talked about, you know, we must have a pessimism of the mind, but an optimism of the will.
Right.
Right. I know you've said that many times, and I know I've certainly tried to take that one to heart, you know, given what we're up against, but what these struggles that we have to basically face, what we have to go through.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important. All right. So, Michael Parenti, thank you very much for joining us today on Back in the USSR. I really appreciate this.
Thank you, Siegfried. Thank you.
Okay. I'll talk to you soon. All right.
Right. Sure.
Thanks. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah. 1, 2, 1, 2. Flow combat, EB, I'm born that, beaches, thorn that, reformat the masses, I'm redrafting the battle maps at top of task list, I build a classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit, I'm sending heads into backspin, attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts, packed with the stat charts and graphs, I got passion, burn mics up to ashes, I make fascists, crap their pants, stanzas, cure culture. Trouble cancer, I got tunes that move you to dance. Burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum. Getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis. My word act like nominally gat, rhymingly packed. Punch, crash the fun by metric tons. And plus my math, distribute cash among the classes. Take from the thieving greedy bastard. Get back like church hats or get past. Collapse structure, fuck facades. I destruct the support beams and bars, wrecking ball large, resistance, subversive diction, flip the shit just like a brick throne, dethrone kings, bring the trees on, my tone rock like Gibraltar pop, hip hop hotter than a rocket shot, I'm crime, think, thought, bring the big dog, teach you to flee from the flock, walk off, switch shit, hit my target, drop like bombs in the form of carpets, I got the target locked on now, oh shit. Pump your fist if you know where we are. That's a rap. Boom bap. Original rap at. Taking shit back. Boom bap. Boom bap. I'm talking true path, master the craft, the pupil, the prof, keep dropping math, boom bap, blast the bazooka rap.
Boom bap, original rap.
representing Toronto. Please put your hands together and welcome Spin.
Dreams come true. Don't ever let anyone tell you they weren't meant to, because each of you were sent to this earth to serve a purpose that the system doesn't want you to serve, so it lurks close, telling you to stop dreaming and scheming and turn on the television and cloud your vision and dim your soul's light. But watch my words take flight with all of my might from my third eye sight while they glisten. Listen, I'm rhyming and climbing because I'm a man on a mission. My mind is a diamond, and this rendition was written to restore your third eye's vision by telling you to put any insecurities and doubts of your mission and your mind out of commission. I'm on a head-on collision with the opposition telling me to ignore my ambition, leaving them dead on collision, wishing they never fuck with my mission. I suffer too much to let the television tell my vision. I will live to see my dreams to their fruition. I will live to see my dreams to their fruition. I'll graduate university having paid off my tuition. All my lyrics and poems will become spiritual ammunition. I'll be a happily married man with lovely children when I'm through wishing. I'll impact this world by seeing my dreams to their fruition. And my intuition tells me that you can do that too. And so can you, and you. And you need to realize that before he was an icon, Bob Marley was a humble janitor in Delaware with a vision. During his early 20s, Che Guevara was broke, working menial jobs, but he was a man on a mission. Nelson Mandela was born in a remote African village, unknown to the world. Check his transition. DMX was broke, homeless, in and out of prison. This poem is so far above this competition. My words aim to inspire through repetition. Don't listen. Close your ears, close your eyes, and feel this composition. Luis Eduardo Mexicano was born in a third world country, not knowing a word of the English language. Now this man stands mighty and strong on this stage, using his words to cause anguish to the minds of the racist oppressors in their own damn language. And they don't even know how to manage, because they know that my poem hasn't even hit Spanish. Pero te estoy viendo, hermano, mirándome a mí. I'm clocking you, big brother, watching me, and I'm famished. I'm hungry to touch lives until I make your evil vanish. And I'll be doing it in two languages, with your English and my Spanish. Dreams come true. Los sueños se hacen realidad. Just look at the strong following that Martin Luther King had, because Martin Luther King had a dream. Seen? Speak your dreams into being and be prepared for the powerful visions you'll be seeing. Take it from me, I'm being blessed with success with every powerful dream I allow my soul and conscience.